think it was a defining book, not only within the Salvation Army, I think it was a defining book within Western culture. I think it had that kind of significance. It, at my most truly human. Is in that process. I may fail in some ways, and I may succeed in some ways. But it's in within that process that I'm becoming truly human. And so are our people, and here's the beauty of it all. And so are these kids that we're serving. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Welcome to the Challenging Evil podcast, brought to you by the Salvation Army's Caring Magazine. Turn good thoughts into good actions. Go to caringmagazine.org. From the dusty pages of Carvoso Gauntlet's book, Social Evils the Army Has Challenged, emerges our Challenging Evil podcast. We believe that this collection of staggering real-life stories of transformation will fire up our imaginations and convictions to fight for a better world today. What can you look forward to in Challenging Evil? Stories of social and spiritual transformation from the front lines of radical justice. Prepare yourself to be amazed.
This is chapter 2. William Booth in 1890 launched a book called In Darkest England and the Way Out. It was a national hit. It was a bestseller. It was a hit, and like all hits, it had a very big reaction. Either people thought William Booth had lost his mind, or other people thought he was a social genius. And of course, it was right around the age of the turn of the millennium, so there was a lot of talk about changing the world. Socialism was gaining a lot of power. Communism was emerging. And William Booth, with this real solid faith, this idea, this gospel sense that when Jesus taught us to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, he meant it. And so he launched this book primarily because the work of the Salvation Army that took him to the slums, to the East End of London, which is where what he called the submerged tenth live, which is the invisible folks that are trapped in systemic poverty. So you're growing up as a little kid. There's no laws to legislate anything in terms of your own care. And partly what the book's job was to help tell the story. This is happening. And a large part of what happens in poverty, and especially systemic poverty, is because it's out of the way and people of means don't go there, they don't see it. And so they're not confronted with it. So the book was meant to be a confrontation of the situation and of what was happening. And part of the Booth's attempt was to actually tell the numbers too. He was suggesting that there are, over a million people, 1.3 million people in this part of the city that were left to their own devices. And it was despairing, which led to darkness, which led to vice, which in their terms of addiction and violence and systemic poverty. And so Booth set out to change it. And he dreamed of a different world. So he said in Darkest England, so half the book is about the dark side of England and all of these things that were actually happening. And he tells it in graphic detail. People were horrified to learn of it. And then the other half of the book, or actually more than that, is The Way Out. And these were ideas, radical, crazy ideas that William Booth had that a lot of people said were impossible and then were demonstrated by early Salvationists as well as other partners in the fight against it. And so the Salvation Army launched this labor bureau and then launched 22 more, a couple years later, and continued to do this. Even today in Australia, we have a program called Employment Plus, which main job is just to get people back to work. But he had, 22, I mean, he had so many different ideas in this book. It is unbelievable. For example, recycling. Now, this is 1890, people. 1890. William Booth said, I can't even see why we're throwing all this paper out. He said, surely there's a way that we can take these things and rework them and melt them down and use them again. So William Booth actually launched one of the first factories for recycling that created paper that he used to use our magazine called The War Cry. One of the things the Salvation Army did out of that book was a de-lousing fumigation program at its shelters. So a lot of people were ostracized and left out because of infectious diseases. And the Salvation Army really confronted that and actually helped to do it in a hygienic way and served the city of London to demonstrate how, 7 years after the Salvation Army inaugurated that provided necessary legislation for that to happen all over the inner cities. And that was a really, really big one. So those are just some tiny ideas. Here's some other things that came out of that: police court and probation work, maternity homes, homes and colonies for delinquent youths, colonies for inebriates and for beggars, eventide homes for the aged, holiday camps for children and poor mothers, leper colonies, hospitals, and many, many, many more. I'm praying this still serves as a great reminder to stir up the fiery imaginations of a prophet who spoke to us and dreamed for us of what it could look like for the world to be a better place because of the gospel being an inside job and an outside one. Keep tuning in as we listen to
Kevin Jackson. Okay, so this is the Challenging Evil podcast, and we're thrilled to have as a guest Kevin Jackson. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we've been just hearing the story of the release of the In Darkest England and the Way Out, sort of that William Booth's book that hit the charts and hit the culture, and really we understand as a defining book for the Salvation Army's mission. Talk to me about what you think of, one, the essence of the book, and two, its impact on culture then, and then also our culture now.
Yeah, all good questions. I think it was a defining book not only within the Salvation Army, I think it was a defining book within Western culture. I think it had that kind of significance. And it showed up in social work, colleges and universities all over the world, not for many years following publication. And so hugely important. I don't think we can underestimate the importance of it. I also think it probably presented a model of ministry that was so far ahead of its time that it became highly problematic even within the Salvation Army. I think it's fair to say that the concepts among Salvationists were probably loved and hated with equal enthusiasm.
Interesting. Talk to me, though, about the difference. And this, I think this is, you know, where we slip into this beautiful Christian idea of charity and this social reformation idea of In Darkest England the Way Out. So one of the striking things about Booth's ideas is none of them really involve charity.
No.
Most all of them involve work, you know, getting people to work, helping people to find affordable meals. I mean, like almost every single venture is about this idea of people contributing to their own well-being. And, you know, so where the Salvation Army slips from this vision, I feel, is not just in its bigness and its risk, but even we just kind of easily turn to this personal piety idea of charity versus this, like, no, like, we mean to change the way systems and structures work.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not a charity guy. You probably knew that. I'm a social justice guy. But I think the book really does kind of establish a framework for us in terms of that. It really could be the furthest thing from charity. Yet when you do a kind of a cursory read of it, when you're kind of looking at it, generally speaking, you could come away with, if you're not being intentional about it, you could come away with, well, isn't that nice and quaint and charitable? He wasn't talking about charity at all. He was talking about changing the world, social transformation, not on a small scale, not in our neighborhood. Yes, our neighborhood. He was talking globally, wasn't he? And so in a world that was concerned with neighborhoods and individuals, he was already talking about on a grand global scale, globalization in a positive sense, a mandate for globalization of this faith that all of these Salvationists have brought together. You know, and sometimes we say too often William Booth, when there were just, that we were talking hundreds of people that were significant in this process. And so, yeah, it's not about charity. It's about social justice.
Give me two examples of something you're doing right now that you think connects to in Darkest England, The Way Out?
Sure. I can give you an example and kind of how we might differ from the approach. Obviously, it was a back to the land movement in part, getting people out of those urban centers and into the countryside, where it was clean air, healthy water, that sort of thing. But what we did is we said, well, that kind of agriculture isn't doable for us in northeastern Ohio, for example. It's just not doable anymore. So what we did is we took the agricultural component of In Darkest England, and then we went out and found the most cutting-edge, robotics-driven agricultural system that was available to us in the world. And when we decided which one we wanted, we went out, we provided our local territory with a kind of our master plan, our In Darkest England approach to agriculture. And so that's what we're implementing here. And so it's farming, but it's farming that doesn't take place over 4 months. It takes place over 4 weeks. So when we grow, we plant a seed. It goes from seed to a head of lettuce in 4 weeks.
Wow.
So we're harvesting 11 and a half times a year our lettuce or any green leafy vegetable.
Is this outside or inside?
That's inside.
It's inside. So it's indoor.
It's indoor. It's computer and robot run. So we have two people that work our farm. We farm by hand what it would take 20 people to do if we did it outside. It takes, and then in terms of the environment, it takes 40 gallons of water to grow a head of lettuce outside. It takes us 14 ounces of water to grow that head of lettuce inside. So we're conserving water, we're recycling water, we're growing food in a way that will feed our community, both literally and spiritually.
That's amazing. You're teaching cutting edge technology to people.
Yeah. I mean, it's so advanced that so we are growing in one of our grow trays. We'll have 3,000 heads of lettuce.
Wow.
And lettuce number 43. Might be struggling. We have sensors in the root system of the head of lettuce, and when the computer realizes that head of lettuce number 43 is struggling, it will increase or decrease the water flow, it will add nutrients or take away nutrients, and it will overcome some of those. So we can grow in 4 weeks because we're using literally a robotic system. Now what we do with that is half of the food we grow goes to direct meals to people who don't have it, the chronically homeless, children in our community. So half of the food we grow is prepared and distributed to people who really are hungry or in need of just a meal, a shared meal. The other half of the food we're proposing, and we're in the middle of this process right now, we market that and we sell that, and that's what sustains the local Salvation Army. And so, that's just what I just shared with you in terms of agriculture is a derivative of the In Darkest England scheme.
Right.
When we looked at the In Darkest England scheme, I understood why it failed in the 1880s and 1890s in the United States. We did not have the capacity to do that. 100 years later, we have the capacity to do that. And so we took the master plan, the blueprints of that, put a 21st century technological spin on what we're doing, and then just implementing it. And so, you know,
this is kind of cool. America is now ready for In Darkest England and The Way Out.
There
That's
you
what
go.
You're saying. That's awesome.
Just have to convince everybody else of that.
We're finally ready.
Yeah, but it's it's not like there aren't a lot of people doing social justice, or excuse me, agriculture.
Yes.
Both of those. The difference is our system is completely operated, developed, operated, and run by children. And
wow.
So we're preparing children. We're giving them critical thinking skills and complex problem solving, and helping them to feed themselves, learning how to navigate their way through life. That's the heart of the In Darkest England scheme, I think. Mm-hmm. It was in terms of, we certainly understand the spiritual side of things. The social side of things were, we're taking individuals who can't or couldn't seem to navigate their way through daily life. Now, 2017, that's what we're attempting to do. Give children the ability at a very young age to figure out how life works. And
this is also it's that idea that somewhere we have to break the cycle of poverty.
Absolutely.
Because what we understand, anybody anywhere who works in impoverished communities knows that it's a cycle. It's generational. It goes around and around and around, and unless something changes, that never changes. You know, like that, it won't change unless somebody says, okay, this is it. And really what you're saying is these kids learning a skill, learning how to think, learning how to grow food indoors in urban, all those sort of things, eating healthy, making good choices, you're breaking the cycle.
Yeah, and that's just it. And really intergenerationally, I mean, we trace our children's families back to the Great Depression, 1932. And so we really have, you know, multiple generations of poverty. Just, there's not much debate there among social scientists that it's pretty easy to trace these steps back to 1932, 1933,
wow.
That area, the Dust Bowl, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so it's, this is really saying, okay, enough of this. You know, no more a box of food and a war cry and a God bless you and we hope it works out. We'll see you next week when you need more food. Enough. No more. We're saying, no, there's nothing wrong with the distribution. We do that. We serve meals every day. We serve 500 hot meals every day.
It's just not enough.
It's just, yeah, it has to be more than that. Yeah. And this is where we go back to Booth. We just say, it's not just about a cup of soup. It's not just about a lasagna that we prepared in our kitchen. It's about those things are wonderful and needed for now. But we're saying enough. That can't be. There has to be more. And if not who? If not us, who? We're putting ourselves out there and saying we are going to solve this, and we're going to solve not only the social, but we're going to solve the spiritual. I mean, I don't want to say we're arrogant about it. We're not arrogant about it. I hope we're humble about it, but we're confident. Mm. We are absolutely confident that this is an incredibly doable thing, and we're going to see for the first time families that have been intergenerationally impoverished for over 100 years, some of them. We're going to break that. We're going to do this. It just, we have the technology.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Yeah. We have more than enough people to try and serve. The missing component was us, the Salvation Army. It wasn't our intention to be a part of the problem, but in some ways we're a part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I say, no, we got to step up. We have the capacity to do this now. We're going to risk. We're going to be obedient. We're going to enact our faith, and this is going to work. And we see it working already. And we're just in month number 7, and we've a long way to go. You know what? I that's why God raised us up, the Salvation Army. They raised us up to change the world, and we need to step up. And so we take that very personally. And in our core, that's our challenge. We're gonna change the world. And so it was interesting. We have a music conservatory that was launching this summer, and so we registered a week at a time. We have 200 kids signed up for week one of our music conservatory.
Wow!
Now that doesn't show me anything other than the fact that there are people in need of something in our community. We just put the word out and bang, more people than would frankly know what to do with. What a great problem to have.
Right.
not where do we put the three sunbeams? You know, what room do you want the three sunbeams to meet into? But it's where are we going to put 200 kids that want to learn how to play a brass horn? And that's how we marketed it. And so, you know, this is God's time, and it's time for us to step up and truly make a difference. And there is risk involved. Mm. I'd love to tell you.
And it's not always going to work, but trying to make it work is actually the win.
Yeah, I think so. And very much on a spiritual level. And so for me, as a person of faith, the where I seem to grow spiritually is in the process of making it happen and seeing it happen and participating with those men and women and children that I'm yoked together with. That's where the spiritual growth comes in. That's where I'm truly human.
Yeah.
That's where, and going back to my Leviticus theology and that I began with, that's where I'm at my most truly human, is in that process. And so I may fail in some ways and I may succeed in some ways, but it's in within that process that I'm becoming truly human. And so are our people, and here's the beauty of it all, and so are these kids that we're serving. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
This episode of Challenging Evil is brought to you by the Brave Campaign. Brave is a catalytic event for girls because 80% of American-born sex trafficking victims come from foster care. We believe that prevention is the way to combat human trafficking. Find out more about how you can get involved at sajustice.us.
We're having a conversation with Martin Ross, who's an officer in the Salvation Army and is known for doing some innovative things and has some fantastic thoughts and ideas around the empowerment and sustainability and sort of the justice idea of work. So, Martin, we're so glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
This whole series is kind of this idea that the gospel is deeply personal. And it's also social in its application. And that's one of the things the Salvation Army really captured from at the beginning. I mean, Booth said there were two things necessary for salvation to come. One was the character of a person had to change, and that was something only God could do. It was an inside job. And then the conditions in which that person lived needed to change. And that's a justice job. That's an outside job. And that's what we're involved in. So now talk to me about these conditions that keep people from work. I mean, I think everybody has this kind of idea that if anybody wanted to go get a job, they just need to go get a job. They're obviously lazy. You know, they don't want to work, so they stay in perpetual poverty. What is that your experience?
No, I don't think they're lazy, and I don't think they don't want to work. I know there's a percentage that may not want to, but I think, you know, and it comes on one of the slogans on my emails and on my cards, and other people say it too, is giving people a hand up and not a handout. And I think what we're about to talk about will appeal to those that find themselves on the liberal side of at least American politics or the conservative side, because we're teaching people how to fish. We're teaching people to get past the cold cup of water. Some of the barriers, I think, it could be incarceration. They could just have storied backgrounds, incarceration. It could be the idea of lack of education, some of their basic needs not being met, the idea of being safe, the idea of being having a place where they can become educated and then where they can become self-actualized. You know, when I first discovered this is when we were doing some of the ministry in some of the underserved areas, we had a tutoring and mentoring program, and that's on the prevention side. You know, our ARCs, adult rehabilitation centers, so forth, those are on the prevention side. And, you know, General Burroughs talked about, you know, this, when I got a chance to meet her once and talk with her a little bit, personally, actually, she said, you know, the Salvation Army is like a bird with two wings. Here's our social service side, and here's the gospel side. Well, I kind of took that metaphor and said we have the prevention side and we have the intervention side. And we need both of those wings going and able and functioning so that we can float and we can even soar. So when we did on the prevention side with tutoring and mentoring and so forth, when we saw the guards come down, we saw that people can learn, even in the most difficult situations. And then moving on to our other experiences from our early appointments to moving on into Lodi with our culinary arts training program. We got exposed to that.
Yeah, talk to me. Talk to me about that. Talk to me about the culinary, because that's really kind of what kicked off this idea, right? That there are more things we can do. Tell me how that worked.
What we saw was that statistics in Lodi, and this culinary arts training program is expanding. My wife and I were the divisional secretaries of the Harvest Initiative and Sacramento Social Services. And maybe one of the reasons that they brought us on board was they wanted to expand it. And it's gone on into Napa. It's gone into a couple of other cities, Southern California, Denver's looking at it. Seattle's looking at it. But so here's what happened. I saw statistics. We saw statistics of now 9 years of classes, two sessions a year of about 10 students, men and women, coming from the Salvation Army Adult Rehabilitation Centers. And we've graduated 130-plus individuals now coming out of Lodi with a success rate of 95% of them not returning back to addictive behavior and within a year and getting employed. And I thought those statistics were phenomenal. And probably about a third of those individuals got involved in the church. So it goes right along with the Harvest Initiative. If we're looking at holistic development, Jesus, jobs and job training, and transitional housing, then the statistics could be, you know, out the roof with people just becoming successful in their lives and believing that they can and that God can. And
okay, Martin, Martin, you're not the only one who thinks those statistics are amazing. Like, those just are amazing. That's not subjective. That's objective. Like, that rate is astronomical compared to the normal recidivism rate. So basically, if you're listening to this podcast, what happens is people go to treatment and get out of treatment and then find themselves back in treatment and then get out of treatment and find themselves back in treatment. So this happens in poverty in general. It's like a cycle of oppression. And there's so many factors that build into this system of oppression that to get out of it almost sometimes seems impossible or maybe like winning a lottery. And so the question becomes, how do we break those systems and create avenues by which everybody can exit poverty so that we don't have this systemic prison, basically, of poverty?
Yeah.
And so this culinary arts program, that was one of the factors. Like, what made it successful? What are the things that are important when we're talking about, like, Labor Bureau and back to work and becoming a contributor to society? What are the things that make it work?
I think the main part is the idea of coming alongside someone, reducing the barriers. There's two main ones. There's three. One, do they have belief? Do they have hope? You know,
right.
Jeremiah 29:11. You know, I know the plans I have for you, right, not to harm you, but to prosper. So we got to give people hope.
Okay, now that sounds like so simple for those of us who live in a life where hope is regularly dished out. But if you come from a background where you would never thought that it was possible for you to do anything with your life, then hope is a significant part of what it means to break that cycle, right? So giving people hope, it sounds trite when we hear it like amongst ourselves, but if you work in places where people are hopeless, you'll understand how it absolutely essential hope is to getting people free.
Yes. And so hope is huge. It's
yeah.
huge. Okay, it's coming along. Coming alongside of them,
yep.
just like we do when we advocate for people in court.
Yep.
This time we're coming alongside of them when they're going to get a job. We're
right.
educating them.
Right.
We're reducing that barrier, so we're training them. And now that they have some skill sets behind, and this is what we've dissected it, because it's not so much what we're training them in. It's the idea that they've gone through several filters, several screening processes to give them next steps to hope. And then once they get that training, they can do just about anything because they have skill sets.
Yeah.
They just have to realize that they have them or get exposed to them because, you know, the attitude determines the altitude. So here's what we've done. Come alongside them, get them job trained, getting them to some type of stabilized housing, some stabilized environment, and then we're rolling. I had a gentleman that was crying that gave some tears with me after a worship service one Sunday. And he said, "Captain, I just got out of San Quentin." He said, "Not too long ago. And no one would take a look at my resume. No one wanted to look at my job application." But he said, "When you came alongside me and you told people that, hey, we're eager to work. We're looking for a second chance. We've gone through the filters. We're not asking for a high wage. We're drug tested and alcohol tested. You helped us advocate and communicate to people that we are a premium set of employees, that a premium sourcing of employees out there." And he said, "And now I got a full-time job." And he said, "I wouldn't have been able to have that opportunity unless you came beside me, because no one was hearing me." And that's the part that's been so exciting. So what, given the economic and just population environment that we have, with 10,000 baby boomers retiring every day now, you know, something around 60 to 70 million baby boomers.
Yeah, we need the workforce, don't we? Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
So,
Martin, just to break this down in my own mind, you're talking about training. So you're offering people training in some respect so they have a specific workable resource. So some training. You're talking about safety in terms of having a place to work from, because that's often if you're homeless or if you have like a volatile home environment, then that's going to be a real barrier to employment. And then third, you're talking about advocacy. So you're suggesting that as the Salvation Army advocates on behalf of people to say, you can trust us as we journey with this person, we're using our capital in a sense, our favor. For in the person's favor, so we're allowing them to access an advocacy that they don't have for themselves.
For more information on the fight for freedom, go to sajustice.us. To download original chapters and a new discussion guide, visit caringmagazine.org. Challenging Evil Podcast is created by SA Justice, hosted by Danielle Strickland, and engineered by Saul Sosa.